Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to History of the Talmud, Volume 14. We are in the year 115-116. The Jews are living under Roman rule, and under Roman rule, they are considered a tribute of the Roman Empire, which is continuing to expand. If you remember, the ruler who destroyed the temple was
Titus,
but Titus's father.
Vespasian
was Titus's father, and Titus his role is taken over by Trajan. Trajan has a goal to expand his kingdom and his rule as far east as possible. That is Trajan's goal. So he is going to be pushing out past the land of Israel, past Jordan, heading towards what we now call Iraq, but to the communities and the places on the Tigris and the Euphrates. As you can imagine, this is very, very far from his base of operation, which is either going to be in Syria or Alexandria, which is in Egypt. So that's going to make life difficult for him. It's also, everyone knows, as we've discovered here in the United States of America, that wars cost money, right? And if wars cost money, you have to get that money from somewhere. So he's going to be taxing the people. So I just want to put out a little bit of statements in the Mishnah and the Gemara about the payment of taxes. So the Mishnah Nedarim, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Gimel, or in some editions it's Mishnah Dalid. So it talks about places where, remember, we're Jews, we're uncomfortable with the whole action of making vows, particularly making false vows. So the Mishnah says, Nodrin, one may take a vow, Laharagin, for capital cases, L'charamim, for potential excommunications, ulemochzin, and you can also take a vow when it comes to dealing with taxes. Shehi truma. You can vow that something is truma, is set aside for the Kohanim, when it is not, in fact, set aside for Kohanim. Afapi she'ena truma. Shehin shel beit melech. Afapi she'ena shelahem. So you can basically lie, according to this Mishnah, and swear about it in order to get out of paying of taxes. So the Gemara in Bava Kamma, which deals with this Mishnah, asks the obvious question, Umochsin, you're allowed to lie to tax collectors. V'ha'amar Shmuel, dina demalchus adina. Didn't Shmuel say, the Gemara in Bava Kamma, Daf Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph says, didn't Shmuel say that the law of the land is law? So how are you allowed to take a vow falsely when it comes to taxes? So Amar Avi Chanina Bar Kahana, Amar Shmuel. So Rav Chanina Bar Kahana said in the name of Shmuel that this is talking about B'moches She'ein Lo Kitzva. It's talking about the never-ending tax, right? A tax that has no end to it. Meaning it is not a tax that says we take X amount percentage from your money, but it's one of those taxes that we are going to continue taking from you ad infinitum, until there's nothing left. Devei Rabbi Yani, Anaya Amrei B'moches HaOmed Me'elav. It's talking about a non-connected tax, a tax that is independent and not one that is connected to any sort of to any sort of governmental project. The Gemara goes on to discuss it a little bit, and what's interesting is the conclusion of the Gemara, which says Matnitin, our Mishnah, Delo k'Rabbi Akiva. Our Mishnah is not like Rabbi Akiva. Ditanya, because we learned in a Braisa, Rabbi Akiva says, Asur lehavriach es hameches. Rabbi Akiva says one may not seek to get out of paying his taxes. Rabbi Shimon Omer Mishum Rabbi Akiva, Mutar lehavriach es ameches. Rabbi Shimon says, no, Rabbi Akiva says, you are permitted lehavriach, meaning to attempt to escape your paying of taxes. So this is odd that you would have two traditions exactly contradictory in the name of the same person. It's important because we know historically, it's important halachically, but it's also important historically for us, because we are dealing in the day and age of Rabbi Akiva. And the question is, why is there tension within within his opinion here as to what he actually held about the permissibility of trying to escape the payment of taxes, particularly even if it would require you to actually lie because of it? That's one of the questions that's existing here, at least historically. And if we look back, I think it's very sensible why there would be this tension. Because it starts out that the Jews, at least in the period of time that immediately follows the destruction of the temple, have created a sort of détente with Rome. The Jews have accepted the fact that particularly the Jews in Israel, have accepted the fact that they will be ruled by Rome. In fact, the rabbis, to a certain extent, rabbinic leadership, is considered to have, at least in some ways, collaborated with Rome in the rebuilding of the Jewish community in the land of Israel. We've already seen Rabbi Gamliel serving as a representative of the Jewish community, either in Syria or in Rome, in order to advocate on their behalf. And though it seems that you have decrees every so often against them, the overall thrust of the relationship seems to be a cold peace between them. The Jews accept the fact that they are powerless, and the Romans accept the fact that they are powerful and everyone's happy, or at least whatever. But as we've also noted a number of times in these classes, there's one personality trait that seems to be consistently there within the Jewish community in these days, which is they have a severe problem with authority. There are numerous reasons why they have a problem with authority. Most prominent, as they say in a number of sources, that the rallying cry for Jewish independence was, we have but one king. The Lord, the one God in heaven, is our king, and he rules over us. He is the only power in this world, and everyone else is just pretenders to that throne. And so that will inspire a messianism. That will inspire a revolutionary culture. Also, their independence, their view, or their exceptionalism, the view of themselves as different from a paganistic world. They are monotheists versus the pagans. There's an us against them, a truthful one, an honest-to-goodness one, an us against them type of feeling. All of those are going to basically prevent the Jews from ever feeling comfortable being ruled over, particularly by the Romans. Why do things get worse? Because Trajan decides to have this massive war in the attempt to take the cities on the Tigris and the Euphrates in what is now Iraq. He wants to expand the Roman Empire all the way to there. This is going to cost him an immense amount of money. In order to fund this war, he's going to have to heavily tax his people. So why is Rabbi Akiva ambivalent about the payment of taxes? Rabbi Akiva, it may be, both traditions are in fact correct. Rabbi Akiva is ambivalent about the payment of taxes because it depends on what tax you're paying. Are you paying the normative tax as a tribute to the kingdom of Rome, that every one of the tributes to Rome is required to pay? Or, you know, are they sucking your very lifeblood in order to support a war that no one in the kingdom is really supportive of? We know that no one in the kingdom is really supportive of this is because the day Trajan dies is the day they stop this war. The one who takes over for Trajan, and we'll discuss him in detail, Hadrian. So the one who takes over for him, one of the first things he does is like, no, we're not pushing that far east. We can't do that anymore. So now you have Trajan trying to move east. So he's taxing heavily the people. And what else do you need to run a war besides taxes, besides money? You need soldiers. So all the best and brightest garrisons that have until now been keeping peace and order in the various tributes are now, what are they going to be doing? they're going to be heading far east to help Trajan in his imperialistic war, which leaves also now a leadership vacuum, to the point where sources of that time have them, they say in wartime, promotions come quick, so you have these great and immense promotions that are happening during the time of Trajan. Because all of a sudden you have people who were low men on the totem pole who are being promoted in order to being responsible. So you have three things working together now. You have a Jewish community that in general is unhappy being ruled by anyone. Now you have them being taxed beyond the pale of what used to be happening. And then if you go even further than that, you have a vacuum of leadership and you have no threat, or you have basically a garrison, a ruling garrison, that isn't looking as scary as the previous garrisons that existed beforehand. So what's going to happen? What you have is a revolt that ensues not from Judea, but a revolt that ensues in Alexandria, on Cyprus. You have revolts which are dominantly led by Jewish exiles. Who were these Jewish exiles? Some historians make the assumption that these exiles were in fact zealots who were exiled from Jerusalem. They're still fighting the war of 70, right? Of 45 years earlier, where they're the children of the zealots. And they're people who, have been raised on the stories of Hate the Romans. And so what we're going to do now is find out a little bit about the way Trajan and ultimately Hadrian squelched this rebellion, and why the squelching of this rebellion, and there's a lot of debate as to whether it spilled over into the land of Israel or not. Even if it didn't, it's clear that the ramifications of the squashing of this rebellion definitely did reverberate within the land of Israel. And it's clear also that it was highly, highly violent squashing. So we go here now to a rabbinic text by the name of Seder Olam Rabba. Seder Olam Rabba, it won't be the last time we see this text because it's an important one. Seder Olam Rabba is a Tanaitic text, although it's probably written after this period of time, not contemporary to it. That being said, it's using the sources, it's clearly using sources that were contemporaneous. One of the things Seder Olam Rabba does is it tries to give a chronology of the history of the Jewish people, going all the way back to Adam HaRishon and the creation of the world. When we say the world is 5,774 years old, this is based on the calculations of Seder Olam Rabba. Okay? It actually has a fascinating approach to the way it counts up years in Tanakh, and that's worth a story in and of itself, but we can discuss that on another time. But here it is counting the Shmona Malchei Yavan, the eight kings first of Greece: Alexandros Mokdon, Alexander the Macedonian, Pirton, Shlomon, Silkas, Santrak, Antioch, Antiochus, Xilkas, okay, and then you have Mi Pumul Shel Asvasyarus, Pul, Ad Pumul Shel Asvasyanus, Shmonim Shana. So Asvasyarus, there was a war until Vespasian, so that was 80 years. Elu Bifnei Habayitz, that was before, they were both kings, before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Mi Pumus Vespasianus, from Vespasian's war, Ad Pumus Titus Chav Dalet Shana, until Titus's war, was 24 years. So the problem is that Titus fought which war? Not his own war, he fought Vespasian's war. So what's it talking about here? Titus. Okay? And then Mi Pumus Shel Titus Ad Milchemes Ben Koziva. So it says, so first opinion is Yudvav, then it says Chafav Shana. So is it 26 or is it 16 years until Bar Kokhba, Ben Koziba is Bar Kokhba. So then you look in some of the footnotes and some of the other sources, and they change the name Titus to the name Titus. Change one word. Not Titus, but Quietus. Who is Quietus? So when you have all this revolutionary action happening on the home front while Trajan is fighting his war, if you're a good leader, what do you got to do? You got to quiet the rebellion. Who better to quiet the rebellion than Quietus? Okay? Quietus was ruthless in the way that he quieted the rebellion. And he basically massacred anyone who attempted to continue in this rebellion. Okay? It's interesting. This makes it into the Mishnah and Sota, Perek Tes, Mishnah Yadalid. Again, you have the same question about the language of the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, "Bepumul shel Aspasianus gazrul al ataros chasanim v'al ha'irus." Right? So during Vespasian, the war with Vespasian, they made a decree against wearing crowns for grooms and also for certain types of erisin. Bepumul shel Kitus Alataros Hakala, during the war of Titus, and again, you go to the Diktuke Sofrim and you go to other texts, and you find out that it's not Titus, but it is Kitos, right? During the Quietus war, they made brides stop wearing their crowns as well. Why? Because there was such a massive loss. Interestingly enough, in the Babylonian Talmud, you have very, very little information about Quietus. The reason for that is the ascendancy of Quietus, in an odd way, basically saved the Babylonian Jewish community. Because who is Trajan trying to take over? He's trying to take over Babylon. He's trying to take over the lands on the Tigris and the Euphrates. Unsuccessfully. Because of the rebellions back home, he is deposed, killed, unclear what happens to him, and Hadrian takes over, and all armies are drawn back from Babylon, and they are focused instead on the home fronts in Cyprus and in Alexandria, where the major revolutions are happening, which leaves the Babylonian community with the opportunity to completely thrive. Right now, right in this very moment, you have the creation of the Babylonian Talmud and the future of Judaism, right? If you want to see the hand of God in history, maybe this is one way you do it. You know, Chazal say that one of the blessings of exile is that we were scattered. Because if all the Jews were in one place, you know, one evil king and we'd all be gone. So here you see one of the blessings of being scattered. Okay? That being said, you go to the Jerusalem Talmud, you will find a lot of information about what went on there. That's because, particularly the destruction of Alexandrian community, which was a massive, gigantic, influential, and enormous community in those days, that community was wiped out, completely gone. It seems there was also a larger community in Cyprus as well that was wiped out by Quietus. So if you go to the Yerushalmi, in Maseches Sukkah, Perek Hei Halacha Aleph, I brought a few here in English. So we have here, Rabbi Yehuda said, whoever had never seen the double colonnade basilica synagogue of Alexandria in Egypt has never seen Israel's glory in his whole life. He now goes on to describe this central synagogue in Alexandria. It was a kind of large basilica with one colonnade inside another. Sometimes there were twice as many people there as the number of Israelites who took part in the Exodus from Egypt. So that's, there's 600,000. So that is 1.2 million people who were able to fit into the synagogue. Is the Gemara exaggerating? I don't know. The point is, there were a lot of people there. A lot of people. It was a massive community. No, it was the five towns, whatever you want to call it, okay? So there were 71 golden thrones set up there One for each of the 71 board members. Just kidding. 71 elders, right? Up front. Each one worth 25 talents of gold with a wooden platform at its center. Right? So you had 71 elders who would sit up on the front on golden thrones. The minister of the synagogue would stand on it with his flags in his hands. So the gabbai, what would he use? He would use flags, right? Because if you're sitting all the way in the back, you have no idea that they started davening. So when one began to read, the other would wave the flag so that the people would answer amen for each and every blessing. Meaning, you had no idea what he was saying up there, but you would just say amen when someone would say it. Then that one would wave the flags, and they would answer amen. So, you know, you would have this, you know, flag-waving system that would allow for it. What's the point that the Ushami is making here? The historical point here is that the community in Alexandria was one of the great prides of the world Jewish community. That in Israel, in probably even in Babylon, and we'll see another source as well about that, in Israel and across the board, Alexandria was considered a major Jewish community and one that had garnered respect of the world. It says here, and just to see what a diverse community was, they did not sit at random, right? But where was it? There was separate seating. How separate seating? The goldsmiths sat by themselves, the silversmiths sat by themselves, the weavers by themselves, the bronze weavers by themselves, and the blacksmiths by themselves. So you would have here a class system that each person would sit in a different area, right? You'd have the accountants, the lawyers, the doctors. There would even be a place for the plumbers. So there's a place for everybody. Why? And why? So was it because it was a class system? So when a traveler came along, he could find his fellow craftsmen, and on the basis, he could find a living for himself. Alexandria was a cosmopolitan community, and you can imagine that a lot of people looking for work in those days might be emigrating from Israel, from other parts of North Africa, from Cyprus, from all over the place, who are coming there looking for work, right? But what would you have to do? You have to network. How are you going to network? What's the best place to network? Shul, right? So you just sit anyway. You know, you're a goldsmith. You sit with the silversmiths. You know, they're talking about things you don't even know what they're talking about. You know, when they say, oh, you're a goldsmith, you got to go to the goldsmith section. Goldsmith section, all of a sudden, you find a partner in a business. And who destroyed it all? Who is this grand, beautiful community? The evil Trajan, right? Trajan, who in his attempt to fight this war, basically created a vacuum of leadership that allowed for the revolt, right? And he went, had to go back and squash the revolt. So Trajan, with his buddy Quietus, what do? They squash the revolt. They destroy not only the revolt, but they knock out, that's the end of the community of Jews in Alexandria. It's a massive day. You do find a little bit of this in the Gemara in Tanis. Gemara in Tanis, Daf Yurches Amud Beis, talks about Trajan's day, Yom Trajan. Okay, a day that was mourned on the Jewish calendar because it was the day that the two leaders of the rebellion, ironically enough, two Jews, Lulianus and Pappus, that was the day that they were killed. And I want you to see here how they were viewed by the Talmud. What is Trajan's day? So the Gemara says when Trajan was about to execute Lulianus and his brother Pappus in Laodicea or Lydia, he said to them, if you are the people of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, let your God come and deliver you from my hands, in the same way he delivered Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. For those of you who remember from Sefer Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were three people who refused to bow down to idolatry. Because of that, Nebuchadnezzar throws them into the fire. And what happens? They survive the fire, and when they come out of the fire, Nebuchadnezzar is so amazed, he wants to sing Shira. And to this they replied, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were perfectly righteous men, and they merited that a miracle be wrought for them, and Nebuchadnezzar was also a king worthy of a miracle to be brought through him. But as for you, you are common and wicked man, and are not worthy that a miracle be wrought through you. And as for us, we have deserved of the omnipresent that we should die, and if you will not kill us, the omnipresent has many other agents of death. So one of the things, what do you see here? So number one is the comparison to other revolutions that existed in the past. Other Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are considered by the Talmud and by Tanakh to be great and wonderful tzaddikim, righteous men who went on to live, you know, important lives as leader of the Jewish people. There's already a sentiment here that the rebellion that was being led by Lulianus and Pappus was not the same rebellion that that was being run by Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. It didn't have the same idealism. It was important, and it was certainly something they respected, the sacrifice that was given by these people, but it didn't have the same kind of quality that existed in the other cases. The Gemara also continues, the omnipresent has in the world many bears and lions who can attack us and kill us. The only reason why the Holy One, blessed be, has handed us over into your hand is that at some future time he may exact punishment of your blood. Despite this, he killed them, and it is reported that hardly had they moved from there when two officials arrived from Rome and split his skull with clubs. So you have here the interpretation, the historiography of the Gemara. What's the historiography of the Gemara? The revolt itself was not an idealistic revolt in the same way that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah had an idealistic revolt. Nevertheless, it was one which had, to a certain extent, a blessing by God, but they understood that it wasn't going anywhere. It was not messianic or revolutionary in nature. That being said, they also recognized that Trajan did not have the same quality as being a messenger of God in the same way Nebuchadnezzar had. You know, Nebuchadnezzar and Sennacherib, they are, you know, the hand of God to punish the Jewish people. Trajan was viewed quite differently, which is why Trajan, at least according to this Gemara statement, was off with his head immediately following his squashing of the rebellion, or perhaps even in the process of his squashing of this rebellion. The destruction wrought by Trajan, by Quietus, by Hadrian, in squashing this rebellion, resonated even later on. To the point where the Gemara in Gittin, Dafnan Zayin Amud Beis, the Gemara in Gittin is the famous Gemara that talks about all the various tragedies of Jewish history. That's where we found the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. But it also has stories of Beitar, which we'll talk about a little bit more when we deal with the Bar Kokhba revolt. But interestingly enough, it also has a story about the destruction of the community in Alexandria. What I want you to see here also is a new type of typology that begins to exist within Chazal. You're going to see a new type of symbolism that we haven't seen until now, or that starts to emerge as a dominant form of symbolism to the point where it really resonates even into Rashi in his time. So it starts with the pasuk of Hakol Kol Yaakov V'Hayadayim Yidei Esav. Right? The Gemara in Gittin Daf and Zayin Amud Beis talks about a pasuk in Bereishis, Perek Chav Zayin, pasuk Chav Beth, the famous story of where Yitzchak is fooled into thinking that his youngest son is actually his oldest son, but not totally fooled. And he says, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. What we have now is the earliest references, or what becomes a dominant reference, which is the synonymity, is that a word? Between Rome and Esav. Right? Edom and Rome become synonymous. You're going to see it in Al-Naharos Bavel, right? By the waters of Babylon. Who is it that the psalmist castigates in that situation? The Edomites, who, while the Beis HaMikdash was being destroyed, were singing Aru Aru Adi Yisodba. They're singing, you know, destroy it until its very foundation. And the psalmist asks, or hopes, that God will one day smash the heads of their babies upon the rocks, and they will flow. That's how angry the psalmist is in Al-Naharos Bavel. But the point is, that Edom becomes a symbol of the Roman government, which is, you can start seeing in Rashi, kind of those references being referring to potentially contemporary Christianity in those days. But you see what it says here, the voice is the voice of Jacob and the hands are the hands of Esau. The voice here refers to the cry caused by the Emperor Hadrian, who killed in Alexandria of Egypt 60 myriads on 60 myriads, twice as many as went forth from Egypt. Again, you have that same number, this notion of a massacre, of over a million Jews in Alexandria. The voice of Jacob, this is the cry caused by the emperor Vespasian, who killed in the city of Beitar 400,000 myriads, or some say 4,000 myriads. That was Vespasian, did this in Beitar. What are the hands of Esau? The hands are the hands of Esau. This is the government of Rome, which has destroyed our house, burnt our temple, and driven us out of our land. So what's fascinating here is, in the same paragraph, you have the destruction of Alexandrian community in the same kind of breath as a discussion of destruction of the temple. So the parallel between the two tells you how significant the loss of the community in Alexandria during the Quietus Rebellion was. The voice is the voice. Another explanation, the voice is the voice of Jacob. No prayer is effective unless the seed of Jacob takes part in it. The hands are the hands of Esau. No war is successful unless the seed of Esau has a share in it. This is what Rabbi Eliezer says. Thou shalt be hid from the scourge of the tongue. This means that you will be hidden from the heated contest of the tongue. So what you have here is during this period of time, this time when conflict between the Jewish people and the Roman government begins to build, you have the creation of kind of a new type of symbolism within Chazal. You have Yaakov versus Esav being viewed as the war between the Jews and Rome. And what we're going to see as time moves on, we're going to see is that the tension very much builds between them. Again, it's unclear whether there was actual fighting in the land of Israel. There's a lot of debate I saw in the historians as to whether actual fighting is happening there or not. But what we do know is that regardless of whether there was fighting or there wasn't fighting, there was definitely the reverberations of the deaths that were very, very much powerfully felt by the Jewish community in the land of Israel, the much smaller community. Is this going to be the inspiration for the Jews of Jerusalem to rebel against Hadrian? Who knows? Possibly. Will it also be why the rabbis are less than excited of supporting Bar Kokhba's revolution? There's a lot of ambivalence, if not outright antagonism, to Bar Kokhba, or as Rabbi Akiva called him, Bar Kokhba's attempted rebellion against Rome. They are not necessarily excited by the idea, to the fact where they are very critical of Rabbi Akiva's decision to be involved in it. But those are questions we're going to have to say. All of it started with this rebellion here, which, again, ironically enough, started not in the land of Israel, but outside the land of Israel, but was very much, you see here, it was a lot of different peoples who had come together, all of them ruled by Rome, but it was very much led by the Jewish people in their rebellion. Again, the problem with authority, the belief in the Messianic era, and the vacuum of Roman leadership, all of that led to this revolt, and the harsh squashing of the revolt by first Trajan, then Quietus, then Hadrian, all of that perhaps laid the groundwork for the Bar Kokhba revolt only a few years later. All right, doctor.
Did the leadership of Cyprus and Alexandria ask help from the Jewish community?
I can't imagine that they did it.
Yeah,
I can't imagine that they did it.
Then refused, must have been refused, right?
Or what could they offer? Yeah. They weren't fighters. They weren't, you know, they could send money, but they don't have money because they're being taxed to death. So what can they do? Yeah, Adam.
So David makes a good point. What we have here is a Talmudic source for talking in shul.
Not just talking in shul, for business networking in shul.
Right, right.
It's not the only one, believe it or not. But yeah, so
I just want to make sure.
Yeah, yeah, so yeah. What happened to that shul, though? Well, just saying. Okay.
Can you imagine those kiddushes then?
Yeah.
Yeah. I know the commentary in, I guess it's told us when he's blessing Esav.
Yeah.
That he's giving him certain parts of Greece as like references to Italy.
Yeah. You know, so I'm saying this is right. This Rome Esav comparison is going to resonate for generations, all the way into the Middle Ages. So,
what did most of these Jews go back to Egypt right after the destruction of the temple?
Why did they go back to
Egypt? When did most of these large amounts of Jews that they talked
about? So they were exiles.
After the destruction.
They went to Egypt for to make a life for themselves because they had no place else to go. Right, which, I mean, that irony is, I don't think, lost on the Gemara, which is why they keep on comparing the Jews killed in Alexandria to the 600,000 Jews who left the land of Egypt. So that comparison is not by chance. Is it an underhanded criticism? I don't know if it's an underhanded criticism, but it's certainly the irony of it is not lost on Chazal there.
Were there more Jews in Babylon at this time than there were in, say, Jerusalem or Alexandria?
Everything's speculative. It seems like the dominant community was Alexandria, and they may have had more than even northern Israel, which is the other dominant community. But I'm only starting to read about the Babylonian community, but it was definitely spared because of this. Imagine if Trajan had made inroads into Babylon, what would have happened to that community? And, you know, we'd be studying, you know, Talmud Yerushalmi today. So, who knows? All right? Thank you.